we're entering our last ox herding picture. I think, Suze, thank you for teaching last week. I think she was on the call or still is. Yeah, she is. Thank you, Suze. And so I'll offer my own interpretation and exploration around this. So those who might be joining us, this is a 10-picture series that we've been exploring this whole year. And it's basically a way of articulating and exploring how the spiritual practice goes in different directions and how we deepen and how we struggle and we release that struggle. And there's different realizations or awakenings that happen. And now in the 10th picture, this month, it's entitled Entering the Marketplace with Extended Hands. Right. So if you're just joining us, you're like, what is going on here? So basically, and the image is a picture of like the laughing Buddha. There's a sense of that, a very joyous, relaxed, a little bit, you know, really disheveled being who's going into the marketplace. So I will read the verse, go through that a little bit, but I want to focus on another aspect of this picture to help kind of bring it all together for all of us. So the verse goes like this. So entering the marketplace with extended hands, barefooted and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust laden, and I am ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. Now before me, the dead trees become alive. All right, so this verse, it's really speaking about integration, taking the depth of our practice and how do we bring it into our lives, into the marketplace. So this phrase of coming into the marketplace is really busy, alive place with all kinds of diversity of people, all kinds of activity happening. And with this open handedness, this extended hands, this reaching out. Well, so much of these pictures have been really this internal solo practice is the way it's been portrayed. Of course, the Sangha is a big part of our practice, but the way it's portrayed is this kind of individual exploration. And this is the first picture that we've come back into the world. In some ways, all those other pictures have been doing this pathway into spirituality that at least they've been portrayed outside of the world. And that's one of the things I want to talk about is how we have to bring both of those together. Integrate both aspects of our spiritual practice and our life. So this is also an image of someone who's very impoverished, you know, no shoes, tattered clothes, but yet there's an openness through the chest, an openness of the heart, and also a sense of that bliss. So it points to that our happiness is not dependent upon our possessions or our circumstances, but it transcends that. At least the spiritual happiness, the happiness that the Buddha taught and discovered. Now, this not using supernatural powers to prolong life, you know, this, I don't want to get too much into the supernatural pieces, but there's a sense of really transcending a lot of things in the world, and yet this willingness to really come into life and not use magical powers to prolong the life. And then the final phrase, the trees blooming, coming to life, dead trees coming alive. So again, we could talk about it from a supernatural standpoint, but I like to think of it instead of that simple way that we let things be fresh. We start to actually see things that were in some ways dead to us. They weren't seeing so clearly. You notice this when you go on a retreat, or even after meditating for a while, that your senses start to wake up. They start to become more acute. There's a richness of the environment. This is things coming back alive. Now, from the introduction to Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the person who gathered all these talks of Suzuki Roshi, Trudy Abbott, I think. Trudy, where she introduced. So Trudy has this nice description of Trudy Dixon. Okay, she's talking about a Roshi, as you know, a Zen master. We can use that to articulate this image of this picture. So Roshi is a person who has actualized that perfect freedom, which is the potentiality for all human beings. He or she exists freely in the fullness of their whole being. The flow of their consciousness is not the fixed, repetitive patterns of our usual self-centered consciousness, but rather arises spontaneously and naturally from the actual circumstances of the present. The results in this, in terms of the quality of their life, are extraordinary. Buoyancy, vigor, straightforwardness, simplicity, humility, serenity, joyousness, uncanny persistency, and unfathomable compassion. Their whole being testifies to what it means to live in the reality of the present. Without anything said or done, just the impact of meeting a personality so developed can be enough to change one another's whole way of life. But in the end, it's not the extraordinariness of the teacher which perplexes, intrigues, and deepens the student. It is the teacher's utter ordinariness. Because they are just themselves, they are a mirror for their students. And this is a lovely description of, you know, of the awakened mind and the way of integrating that into life. It's not something that's, you know, magical or supernatural. It's actually very ordinary, and yet it's very transformed. Right. So this is how we can, this last picture really captures this. So I want to also now focus most of this evening's discussion with you around this topic of integrating our spiritual practice into our lives, into our daily lives. Now, how do we, you know, this image here, this talking about the enlightened experience, can be very helpful for our practice in terms of aspiration, of where things leading, but also can sometimes create a sense of discouragement as we get this sense of, here I am caught in all my reactivity, all my neuroses, all my suffering, and I see this image of the Buddha or this enlightened being so far away, it's unsurmountable, the distance between me and that person. So sometimes it can have the effect of actually discouraging or disempowering our practice. We see, okay, I can't get there. That's too much of a stretch for me. So I want to kind of reframe that to bring that down into even whatever openings, whatever insights we have, even the little ones, these little shifts actually can be very significant as we integrate that into our life, actually integrate how we live our lives by how our growing wisdom and compassion shows up. Because this is really, even though this is seen at the end of this whole series, it's really a step that's always going on. We're always integrating how we're practicing. We have a deep practice, we integrate that, we test it, and then we see, how does this actually hold up? How does it actually affect our lives? So, and a common question that comes up for people is, how do I integrate my life into my practice? How do I work with this relationship, with parenting, with this conflict? How do I work with these much bigger issues, the suffering of the world? Because it seems like it's difficult. And sometimes I wonder, how can you not practice with those things? How can then your practice just come right forth in that? Because naturally, they really could be and should be part of our practice. So sometimes there's things that get in our way for that integration. Sometimes it comes from the question of, how should I act? What's wise action in the midst of this? How do I act with kindness, with wisdom, when those qualities seem so inaccessible in the midst of my normal reactive mind? Sometimes we find ourselves in this place of limbo, that we're starting to see more clearly the nature of suffering, and we can see, you know, the impact of it, but we don't see how we can actually cross that bridge. How can we cross that flood? the momentum of our conditioning is so strong, so powerful. It keeps us stuck in our patterns of reactivity, and yet we can see our reactivity more clearly. So in some ways, it's kind of a really painful place because we see how much harm we're causing ourselves and others, but we don't see the pathway through it. And there's also the difference between what our practice looks like, the actual mechanics or the mode of practice, versus what our practice is designed to teach us, how it's designed to transform us, how it changes our very view. So often when we have trouble integrating our insights or our understanding into daily lives, it's often confusion about what practice is versus what it teaches us, or also maybe the mode of practice. Or sometimes it's our aspiration, or our sense of, not aspiration, but our sense of idealism, our projection of what it means to be enlightened, what the Buddha was like, and how far away I am from that. So in some ways we say, it's so far away, I'm just going to give up. I'm not going to even try. So I want to explore these three things with you. The mode of our practice, how do we actually practice insights, you know, that transformation, and also this idealism that gets in our way. So let's start with the idealism, right? Because in some ways that's the one that I think is the most sticky, because we don't even realize that we're set up this huge barrier to our practice and our lives. Because we often have this fantasy of what it means to be awakened, what it means to be divine. That the book called What the Buddha Taught by Ruhula, he makes this point that often the Buddha taught in the negative. He told not so much what enlightenment was, but more what it wasn't. And Ruhula was saying, the author was saying in that, that was because that if you say what it's not, you're releasing, you're letting go of. But if you say what it is, the mind has something it can attach to, hook onto. And then as soon as it hooks onto, it pushes that very thing away. So we can have this subtle sense of attachment around these ideas or ideals of what it means to be awakened, what it means, like this picture points to. And when we hold ourselves to that kind of ideal, there's so much internal pressure, especially when it comes conflict with what we really are experiencing, what our natural humanness is experiencing. How can I be in a constant state of bliss, as this phrase says, when I'm lost in an argument with my spouse, with my child, with when I'm dealing with my coworkers? And so if I have those very human experiences, those human emotions of lust, of anger, of fear, I can't be spiritual. In some ways, this is using the Dharma against ourselves. We're using it as a way to disown or disallow some aspect of ourselves. And when you find yourself doing that, that should be a wake-up call that your practice needs some tweaking. So it needs some realignment, some recalibration. Because we look at the Buddha and we have this idea what the Buddha must have been like. You know, he seems so above all of this. The Buddha could never have fear, never have anger, never had suffering. You know, he taught, you know, the end of suffering, right? But really what he taught was the end of dukkha. And we translate that as suffering and all that that holds for us. What he taught was how to see through this illusion of self, freeing our consciousness from this delusion of an isolated self. And that's when doing that, then we open to what's beyond change, beyond impermanence. This is really the subjective experience, the lived experience of this, but it's not reverting the physical laws of the universe, of the world. It's just how we experience those. Now, my sense is that the suttas, when you read them, there's a way that the actual human person that we call the Buddha, that humanness has often been kind of edited away, or we're not going to talk about that part. We're going to not talk about his struggles, but actually how his realizations. And so we get the sense of this supernatural being. I was reading a sutta and looked at the commentary to the sutta, and it was something about the Buddha was you know, taking a bath or something like that. And the commentary was, well, actually, the Buddha was so pure that dirt would not stick to his skin. But he was just taking a bath, so the monks and nuns, which probably just the monks at that point, would feel, okay, he's one of us. But he was just doing that as compassion. So you know, you read that and you start to have this idea, wow, the Buddha, I mean, dirt definitely sticks to my skin. I don't know about you guys, but it's very, you know, it's like, that's so unattainable. All right. So my question often is, when we hold the Buddha that way, is that really helpful to our practice? It may be very helpful to have that sense of devotion, a sense of really seeing something much bigger than yourself. And if it starts to make it be like, okay, I am, it diminishes yourself, then I question how helpful that actually is. Especially when we disallow our humanness. And you can see suttas where the Buddha gets angry at people. I mean, he cusses people out. He calls them insulting names. I mean, he's laying it into some people. And I love that they kept those suttas. You know, this dealing with physical pain, with emotional pain. So for myself, I tend to hold the Buddha not as a supernatural being, but as a very gifted, very insightful person who discovered something very profound, who awoken in a very deep way and was able to really integrate that over many years and teach it. And, you know, that's really, you can awaken, but to actually communicate that, to lay out this path, there's such genius in that. And we all have our own potential of seeing that, of walking that path. The Buddha would say that I wouldn't teach it if it wasn't possible for you to do it. I wouldn't ask you to do it if you cannot do it yourself. I think that's so important. We sometimes, the Buddha is so far away, this is so far away from our practice, from our actual capacity. Because that idealism can rob us of our capacity to work, to get in there and struggle. Because we think an enlightened person wouldn't struggle. So accept the fact that you're a human being. You're going to have very real human experiences. We're just learning how to work with them, how to see through them, how to transform them. Because not allowing yourself to be human makes it hard to integrate our lives into our practice because we're too busy trying to obtain perfection, trying to obtain something which is unattainable. So idealism. So all these, as many of my talks are very practice-oriented. So this week's homework is going to be looking at how we integrate our life into our practice, or our practice into our life. And idealism is one of those lenses that can get in our way. The second one is understanding the different modes of meditation. Okay, what I mean by modes is that when we practice in a retreat setting, when we practice also just in our daily formal practice, that's a certain mode. It's a way of practicing that we're really secluding ourselves. We're letting go of our normal responsibilities, our need to interact with other people. We're just meeting the moment. We're learning to train our attention, steady our attention, and also transform the quality of that attention. So it sees without trying to distort, sees without trying to judge. So there's a direct, clear seeing. And often we struggle because we think, okay, that mode, I have to somehow bring that right in the midst of daily life. Having an argument with my spouse and I'm really upset. It's like, okay, let me just try to breathe here. Let me feel this breath. You know, it doesn't work very well because it's too charged. Things are going on too quickly there. It can be a time later on to go back and practice in the midst of all those echoing of experience. There's three aspects of this particular point. Like, how do we practice really in daily life is the other way of saying it. One of my favorite ways of doing it for myself, and I like to teach this, is to start to attune yourself to that emotional, the physical expression of the emotionality, right? So when you notice that clenching, that tightening, that sense of dis-ease that accompanies emotion, learning to kind of in some ways, relax a little bit our obsession with the content of the emotion, the object of the emotion, and notice the actual felt experience of that. The felt sense, by the way, that's a psychological term that I was reading. I was doing a talk, I think, pre-pandemic, and that felt sense is a particular, you know, lineage of psychological work. And they discovered that when people who could have that felt sense during therapy work actually were able to have a much better outcome versus if you just stay in your heads. So this, how do we feel this in our bodies? How does it show up in our bodies? So basically, we're taking that same skill we learned of steadying our attention and having that be noticing, okay, there's that little tension in the body as I'm saying this thing that may not be completely true. As I'm feeling that insult come at me, where does that show up as a body experience? So that allows us to have this whole field of the body also be a place of information. So often when I'm talking to someone, when I'm listening to someone, I'm also keeping some awareness reserved on the body. And I can feel kind of as the conversation goes the different directions, where those little edges are. It's like, oh, that's a little edge where I'm like, I'm uncomfortable about what's being said or what I'm saying. And that's a cue to pay attention, to really bring more energy to. Am I really speaking in a truthful way? Am I speaking in a kind way in this moment? Or if I'm, you know, there's a sense of, okay, I'm being, you know, maybe lied to, or maybe there's a sense of an attack coming. How do I advocate for myself? How do I have boundaries? How do I stand up for myself? How do I stand up for someone else? You know, you start to trust that more and more than what your mind does. Because you can also feel, because what you notice is when you're aligned up, there's a way of just, okay, is it settled? There's a sense of fluidity in the system and the inner sensations of the body, and versus when there's not. Another aspect is just simply staying a little grounded while you're talking. Like as I'm talking now, I'm feeling my feet, I'm feeling my hips touching the ground. Having some way to broaden your awareness a little bit beyond that tunnel vision that we often get. Just being aware of the space in the room. Just that little bit of a slight shift, a slight broadening. It's amazing how much that allows us to be much more responsive and able to really flow with life versus when we get really narrow, you lose that. When we get triggered, when we get hurt, we lose that. So remembering to feel the feet, feel the breath, you know, have a broadness of attention. And then the other major one is noticing that sense of attachment to views, to opinions, to ideas. Okay, I don't want to let go of that, or I feel like I am right and you're wrong. A place when we dig our heels in, when we feel attacked or insulted, discounted, when we feel like we have to assert our views. So whenever, what I like to do is notice when that happens to, again, pause and pay attention, just like I would notice some sensations in the body. So I feel that, okay? There's that, oh, I really believe in what I'm saying here, or I believe I'm right and you're wrong. You know, there might be a relative truth to that, but paying more attention to that. Say, okay, let me really notice it. Because if I don't notice that, then I'm going to act from that. And if you want an example of that, just watch some of the political display that's been going on for the last months and months. Yeah, so when we get focused, and this is what I think is right, and I think you're wrong. Right. So basically, in this noticing the mode, so shifting from this kind of secluding our senses, connecting with something like the breath or sensation in our formal practice and retreat practice, is in daily life, we have this background availability. And we just kind of bring this, okay, I'm going to be willing to be present, to be awake here and noticing, oh, there's that tension in the body, emotion, fear. Pay attention more. There's that gripping around some opinion, some idea. Ah, pay attention. Oh, there's, I can feel the feet. I can feel the breeze against my face. This allows us to be much more present, much more flowing with what is happening in this moment. And also able to make quick course directions. If we're caught and not paying attention, it's where we often have to catch up. So this is a big part of integrating our practice. And it's not only integrating what we learn, it actually gives us really a lot of grist for the mill, as the saying goes, for our practice back on the cushion. Because in our life, this is when we start to see where we really identify, where we're caught, when we're really stuck. You know, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Characteristics, those aren't just theoretical things. Those are things that show up every moment in our lives. Maybe not every moment, but they show up every day in our lives. The five hindrances, they show up all the time. And learning to see those real life, that's such a gift to give yourself. And so using this way of changing our mode of practice to engage in that way allows what we learn from the suttas, what we learn from Dharma study, from Dharma talks, to actually see this is how it's actually showing up real time in my life in a very concrete way. Right? So you often see the suffering of it, and you also get to see the release of that suffering. You start to see the release of the suffering, and there's a tremendous amount of joy and energy that starts to come for practice, because you realize, wow, this is the way I can start to find my way through this tangled world of my life. And then action, this becomes this perfect, I don't want to say perfect, but it becomes this lovely, what's the right adjective? It becomes a very significant, how about that? Significant launching pad for wise action versus my reactivity. Versus my contraction. It's like, why is action? Okay, here's, I'm coming from my heart. Here I'm coming from stillness. So the mode of practice changes. Doesn't practice in daily life looks different than practicing on the cushion, right? But it's still practice. It's very much practice. And it's a very needed part of our practice to learn how to integrate life and Dharma practice. And the final aspect is what I'm going to call practicing our insights. This is a phrase that Christina Feldman would often talk about, that practicing our insights. We may have some understanding, some realization, some seeing into the nature of things. We see a release of our assumptions. We see things more clearly. Right? It could be small ways. It could be big ways. Just realizing, well, how often my thoughts come up around a particular thing, patterns of reactivity, the falling away of those patterns. So many different ways insights arise. But taking those insights, sometimes they just simply change how we are in the world. Like one, here's an example. I was talking to Ann, my wife, about this, that I used to not really like chit-chat with people. I didn't like to just kind of hang out and talk like at parties and stuff. But somehow that's changed. And I'm actually can just hang out and talk and just, you know, have this dialogue and not have that sense of, okay, I got something better to do. I got to do something else. Even if I'm a host at the party, there's an availability. So I don't intend to change that. I didn't make it happen. It just something shifted. Something let go in me. And that's probably a nice way of saying it, that often things just let go. You don't even realize what happened, what shifted. And just suddenly you find that there's this other capacity in life that was really inaccessible before. Often the people around you might tell you that. You notice that, you know, you actually listen more deeply. You're less reactive. You're more kind. You listen to feedback more clearly. So listen to those, you know, to encourage you. And you also notice that sometimes these insights arise, like some of the ones that may feel very, like some of the previous pictures, when there's this really opening into stillness, the opening into non-self, and then where does that go when we come back home? Where does it go when we're back in, away from our retreat? You know, I said this a few weeks ago, Ram Dass, I think, said, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a week with your family, right? So this is the talk about how do we actually spend that week with our family? How do we actually integrate what we're learning into that nitty-gritty? It's actually a nice little preparation for Thanksgiving. That's sometimes I talk about, you know, the generosity and thankfulness, and sometimes I talk about you're around all the people that push all your buttons. How do you work with that? So it might be more of this kind of a year. This is a nice preview for that. So when we find ourselves those places that, wow, I thought I understood it, but it just goes out the window when I'm with that particular person, in that particular situation, I just find that, wow, all my stuff comes right back. I see some nods. Yeah. Right. So how do we practice with that? That's where the practicing the insight comes up. So the insight ideally gives you this kind of window, this change of view, that suddenly, wow, you realize there's an absence of something that has been there. Okay, and what's that like? Now, that absence, when it's not there, when you re-engage and you're back into your neuroses, it's helpful to recall that, not as a way that, oh, God, I've messed up, I'm such a failure as a student. More noticing that, oh, something is contracted here. There's actually something about this experience that's causing my heart to close. That's causing my reactivity to come up. Isn't that interesting? Let me become curious about that. Let me turn toward that. Now, if you can start to have that attitude toward it, then it really transforms it. Usually our attitude is like, oh man, I'm never gonna be like the Buddha. I'm never gonna be able to be enlightened. I'm just a failure as a meditator, right? That's often the way we go. But learning to actually turn it on its head to say, wow, this is actually a gateway into my practice. So sometimes we need to bring it more clearly to our forefront of our awareness. So writing, for example, writing clearly out. Okay, what's the thing that I understand? What's my truest understanding? And then noticing how that, you forget that in those situations. Because writing it makes you write, actually articulate in a clear way, this is what's happening, this is what I'm seeing. Having a sense of maybe working with a dyad, with another person, working with a dyad with yourself. So whatever insight you might have, when it feels inaccessible, when you have trouble integrating it, see if there's a way to practice with it. How can I start to notice it? Here's a cue, a clue or a suggestion, I should say, is try to notice it in the smallest ways possible. Right? The small ways that you lose it. When you still have enough momentum of the release of it, and you can see the small ways you contract, that teaches you that whole mechanism. If you're trying to go right into the heart of the most difficult relationship in your life, yeah, it's going to be hard to hold that. But if you start to have, you know, little small gains, little small insights, little small ways of fleshing it out, of integrating that insight, of practicing the insight, then when you come into those big situations, then you have more of a ground. You have more of a set potentiality. Often you surprise yourself. You realize, wow, I thought that was going to be such a difficult thing, and something had shifted. Something had fallen away. So these three aspects around integrating our practice. So this image of this Buddha-like person coming back to the marketplace with open arms and choosing not to use his magical powers, and dead things coming alive, the trees coming alive. You know, it can be aspiration. But remember, we can practice in very small ways. We can practice with whatever insight, whatever understanding we have, right here, right now. Tomorrow, the next day. You know, letting go of that distance between you and the Buddha. Saying, whatever the Buddha understood, I have the potential to see that for myself. I can see it in this moment. Don't even think about this lifetime. Just think about its potential to see is here right now. You know, let go of the idealism that makes you so distant from the Buddha. Play with the mode, the way you practice. Meditation practice has many different expressions, different ways of engaging. And daily practice, life practice, engage practice is different than our sequester practice, our secluded practice. And also bring those insights, bring those to the forefront, things that you're really curious about. How does this sense of impermanence really show up? How does it show up when I'm talking to someone? How does it show up in my relationship to my possessions, to my relationships? Whatever is alive for you, that's the place to start. That's a place to integrate. Once that's integrated, then the next thing. It's an ongoing process of deepening and opening. All right, so thank you. Let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. All right, before we open to any questions or sharing, I want to just talk about the homework. And next week we'll have a discussion around it. So I know it's a little off because I was teaching with Tuari last Monday and Suze did her own talk, but we'll go from this place. So the homework, you should have got that online. And if you didn't, maybe Bob, if you could repost that. It was in room. There's actual physical copies here. So it starts with just the reflection that a spiritual practice kept in isolation has a limited benefit. Okay, so if you look at your meditation just as this thing you do, you get it done, then you don't worry about it. Don't have it. It's not coming into your life at all. It has a limited value. How can we integrate our Dharma practice really into the fabric of our life, into all those little pieces? Which parts do we tend to hold out, tend to keep away from our Dharma practice? Which ones do we have trouble integrating? Let's reflect on these three things. What's the nature of that difficulty? Just kind of notice it. In these three areas I talked about, I'm sure there's other ones, but is it a sense of spiritual idealism? Is your ideals getting in the way of you integrating? Like, for example, I shouldn't be angry at this person, this coworker, because that's not Buddhist, right? So I'm disallowing the very anger I have. I'm not meeting that anger. I'm denying it, right? So that's adharmic. So instead, turn toward the anger. Learn to meet it, open to it. See what needs to be done around it. Notice the mode of meditation. Maybe you're trying to find, okay, I'm going to have that, you know, just each noting each breath, each sensation. It's not going to work so well in the real fast pace of an interaction with another person. And finally, how do we practice our insights? How do we actually take an insight and really engage it into our lives? How does it show up? And if it's really a deep insight, it should show up in all aspects of your life. All right, so with that, let's see if there's any questions here in the room or online. If you have one online, you can just simply raise your virtual hand, and in person, you can raise your physical hand. All right, so Ayman, go ahead. Ayman?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess I'll ask a question since no one else is. But I am wondering if, you know, what I've been sort of faced with in my practice these days is having kind of reoccurring feelings that I know bring unskillful action, for example. And it can last like a really long time. And I'm wondering, you know, for me, one of the things that I value, I guess, is that I don't want to give up. So I want to keep trying to like be with the feeling and sort of noticing it and letting it pass. But at some point it gets really tough, you know, if it keeps reoccurring. And I'm sort of wondering what you can do to keep, be mindful of it, but not, you know, it's kind of like a balance where you're mindful of it and you're, but you're not giving into it, but you're also not pushing it away. It feels like an endurance test almost, but for working with it through mindfulness. So I'm just wondering if you can speak to that at all.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, that's nicely articulated. And often when that's, you have that sense of just endurance, like I'm just, this just keeps going. It has this momentum. You know, I keep paying attention to it. I'm noticing it, but just keeps on going. And plus there's the constant, sounds like the pressure of not acting from it, because you can see it and you can see how it wants to go into unskillful behavior. And you don't want to do that. So, but yet it just keeps on going. Is that kind of describing it and how to work with it?
Yes.
Yeah. So what I've found for myself in my own practice, when I feel that kind of, it feels untrackable, that stuckness, that pattern that just keeps going on and on and on, I'm often seeing it, but only seeing it partially. So the mindfulness, sometimes we're seeing it, we're paying attention to it, but we're kind of like trying to look away at the same time. It's like, this is unpleasant. I don't really want to see it, but I'm trying to be a good meditator and turning toward it, right? And so basically describing that sense of aversion to that experience, because it's painful, it's unpleasant. What I found is that when I'm able to somehow notice that aversion in the midst of my observation, then I can see, okay, what's really, let me look a little more closely. Let me open to this in a different way, in a more complete way. And when I often are able to do that, there's this surprise that happens, that I realize that this thing that seems so strong and so unchangeable was actually a fairly superficial turbulence. It's like the turbulence on the top of the ocean. Going down underneath that turbulence, you know, maybe 10 or 15 feet below the surface, it's much calmer, but it's also much deeper too. So often when I do that, there's like, let's say I'm irritated, I'm angry, I'm just pissed off. I pay attention to it. I allow that. I don't try to change it. And that's really, truly like almost like bowing to it, opening your heart, releasing defensiveness around it. Something about letting go of it in that way allows you to see it more clearly, and seeing it, then you see underneath the deeper element. Touch that deeper element, then the superficial thing starts to fall away. And in terms of your actions, you realize, well, these actions are trying to solve this superficial problem, not the deeper problem, the deeper hurt, the deeper tenderness. When you touch into that deeper tenderness, there's often, if it is a deeper one, there's often a corresponding stillness, a corresponding subtleness, or at least a movement toward that. There's a sense of, okay, I feel this more clearly, what is here. So how to get to that when it's kind of stubborn, when it's like, you know, it's just kind of stuck in that pattern. So sometimes it can be as simple as okay, I want to open to this. I want to see this in a complete way. Sometimes you can feel the body open to it. Sometimes taking it for a walk can be really helpful. Just kind of painting it on the trees, letting it be like, okay, let me just express this. Let the spaciousness of nature teach me that own inner spaciousness. Sometimes writing it out. This is what I'm believing is true, is the crux of it. What do I believe is true around this? And then pause, feel the body, and then seeing what arises from that. And that pause allows a deeper wisdom to start to come up. And that way it changes from being like this endurance game to something actually this kind of this exploration that's actually once you start to open to it, it becomes actually pleasurable. It's actually becomes interesting to see all these things which are unseen, especially when you feel that falling away. But staying up on where those waves are just, you know, buffeting with the white caps, that's not so pleasant. Does that make sense, Emma?
It's Iman. Yes. That really helps a lot. And I think I had glimpses of that too. It's interesting because I'm kind of at the point in my mindfulness where I realize that the unskillful action is not something I actually want. It's just this weird pull that's like, you know, but it's not actually what I want to do at all. And I'm not, so like, it's kind of that endurance for me to keep feeling that pull, like of the wave, like you're saying, and being in the white water. But then I think I'm sort of diving a little deeper, but it's a lot of growth, I guess, but it's a good thing. And what you said really helped. So I'm very grateful and appreciative.
Yeah, you're welcome, Iman. Yeah, it's that place of limbo that I was talking about in the talk that you're seeing more clearly, but you're still kind of in the midst of it. So it's kind of this, the clear seeing is kind of uncomfortable. And one piece as you were talking about that is to, you're basically trying to see how do you take form? How do you identify? How do you create that sense of you in relationship to this pattern? And kind of the other side of that is the willingness to see through that, to actually see, you know, where am I identifying? Where am I saying this is staking my ground? This is who I am. This is what I am. And be willing to see through that, to actually see the potential. What are you if you're not that? Whatever that might be. And that train starts to open up to some deep fields of stillness.
Yes, that really helps. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Iman. Nice to hear from you again. Sorry, I muted myself. I just said we have a person online. I'm gonna switch the camera so you could see him. All right, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I'm Adam. As you were talking about idealism, something came to mind, and I want to get your thoughts on it. So, at some point I read or heard somewhere about the sensation of longing as practice. Mm-hmm. And as you were talking about idealism, I thought about times where I had that kind of block of experiencing, oh, I should be this way. Mm-hmm. And something that I've encountered that helps me with that is to connect with it through longing, thinking of it as this like, yes, this is something I aspire to. And it's usually connected to being connected with other people or other, mm-hmm. you know, being part of a bigger thing. Yeah. And that sense of longing, I feel like it helps to connect with the intention behind the idealism. I just wonder if you could comment on that and as a form of practice or the skillfulness behind that or lack thereof mm-hmm. or misunderstanding of idealism there.
Sure. So I'll switch back here. So if I understand you correctly, that Adam, there's that sense of longing, and it's often that like longing for connection or for, you know, with the practice, kind of what the potential that it holds. And how that spiritual idealism, you could see that in the past that kind of kept you a little bit away from it or seemed too far away. And how do you integrate those two or how do they relate to each other?
Yeah. So
let me give a stab at it. See if I get it for you. And if not, we can keep going till we do. Longing is an interesting word because we can long from different places, right? I can long from my head or from my ego or from my sense of craving that, oh, I just really need that possession. I really need that. I want that. That's going to make me happy. But it can be kind of from this whole mental fantasy. There's another way to long that's more of this kind of heartfelt, this something that's actually pulling you in a way that's, you feel that it's really not, you're not really sure why it's pulling you. It's not really like you're trying to make yourself something different, but you're just, your heart is somehow pulling yourself into something that's bigger than you. So that's beyond your normal isolation. And that kind of longing, that's really what brings us into our practice. That's why we sit down with this, okay, you know, I feel that aspiration, that heartfelt longing for deepening, for opening, for intimacy, for freedom. And that's a beautiful point of practice. And that's part of, we could say, part of the faith of practice. That's ox herding pictures. That's the very first picture, that searching for that ox that comes from that place of yearning, of longing. Right? So, and you can also notice, you can sometimes, I can switch. It's like, well, once I get enlightened, then I got, you know, I got it made. I don't have to worry about anything, or I'm going to be, all my problems are going to go away. That's, we can see how we can shift into that. So it's kind of that, when I start to be led by my head, my ideas, versus that heart, really the heart pulling us forward. Does that help, Adam?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. What else is out there? All right, Kathy, go ahead.
I have this question about what you were talking about when you're practicing, when I'm sitting or when I'm with someone and hearing them speak, or in any situation, and I'm feeling some physical discomfort or nervousness or agitation, or like when I was sitting tonight, I realized I was fidgeting and feeling very anxious. And so I'm noticing things like this and thinking, oh, okay, now I know that if I can just stay with this in my body maybe I will, it will soften, or it will leave me, or I will figure it out. There's part of me that wants to figure it out, but where do you go from there? I would be interested in what you have to say.
Well, yeah, certainly that sense of noticing that kind of fidgetiness, or that just of agitation or restlessness or whatever it might be, and that turning toward it. But the way you described it, you turn toward it in order to get over it. It's like you're negotiating. Okay, if I pay attention to you, then you can stop, right? You know, if I listen to you, then you are stop talking to me. That there's that attitude that we might have, that we were kind of endure it in order to get rid of it. Now, the tricky thing is that little bit of, and I'm doing this conditionally, I'm paying attention conditionally, that actually kind of, it's, there, of course, there's a little bit of that aversion. There's a way that we set up this friction or this charge between us and what we're observing. That charge is going to keep us a little bit removed from it. Paradoxically, it's going to tend to make that thing continue on. So I feel what I would say when it's unpleasant, step back and just say, acknowledge, oh, this is unpleasant. You know, have some compassion for you going through an unpleasant experience. You know, it's like, okay, this is not my preference. So you acknowledge the whole gamut of what's here. The more completely and fully you acknowledge what's present, then you're actually creating the best environment to actually learn from it, to actually be transformed by it. But we have even a little bit that I'm paying attention in order for it to get rid of it, to overcome it. Then it does have that, you know, it kind of actually keeps it going. That's, I think, you know, that's part of like I'm in question is that there's often that little, what's that secondary relationship to what we're having? We have that secondary relationship's not acknowledged, then it tends to drive it. It really distorts the way we see. And you notice this by when times you really say, okay, I remember people, some teachers talking about patience. It's like, you imagine that you're going to be with that. You're locked in a, for some reason, this must have been New Yorkers. You're locked in a subway car with this group of people for the rest of eternity. You got to learn to live with them, to meet them. You know, so it's like, okay, this is just, let this be here as forever, this restlessness. Okay, then suddenly you start to relate to it. Maybe you start to actually notice it in a way that's not laced with that little bit of trying to get rid of it. It's really tricky because it's so natural as a human being to want to get rid of what's causing us distress, what's causing us suffering. We want to use Dharma practice as a way of different tools to get rid of stuff, right? So that works. It does work to some degree, but in terms of these deep transformations, that part we need to see through because it keeps us at this distance from what we're seeing. So that being said, so when you find yourself doing that, just say, okay, what is here? Acknowledge that, okay, I don't like this. I want to get rid of it. I want it to be here. All right. And I'm going to try to breathe through it. I'm going to open to it. Right. And then the more you can fully open to it, yeah, at some point it might get to the point where you have to really do something different. Maybe you need to notice, well, my leg is just really hurting. I need to shift. Or maybe it's just this wave of hindrance that's just moving through the system and then it falls away. And sometimes there's a deeper belief that you're not acknowledging, like, wow, you know, he's talking about integration, my practice, and I feel like I'm not doing that very well. Maybe that is what needs to be acknowledged. Right? So it's really interesting. The more deeply we just meet the moment, just how it is, basic 101 meditation techniques, you know, this goes all the way through. What is this moment holding? How are we relating to it? And then trusting that in itself will transform it.
Oh my. Thank you, Tim. That's really, really helpful.
You're welcome, Kathy. All right. What else is out there? All right. The online, sometimes I feel like I need to make a tally of questions from online versus in the room. I don't know why I get... Anyway, so go ahead, Kathy. Go ahead, Carla.
Hi. My question is related to insights. So just yesterday, I had an experience that I've had many times before, a recurring pattern. Someone did something that I felt annoyed by. The ego says, you know, the annoyance is justified. Maybe you should ask for what you need or what you want. But there was enough awareness to say, this is a recurring pattern. This is actually a very, very deep personality trait. And I could choose kindness. It was really between getting things to be just the way I want them to be and just letting it go and being kind. And the ego won. It wasn't terrible, but you know, I had a certain amount of awareness and that I was able to phrase my request in a kinder way or sort of ask for what was going on with that other person. But later on, it felt kind of icky, you know, it felt like, you know, I could have been kinder. It could have been less about me. And it felt like a real moment of insight. Like I felt a real sense, like I had this glimpse of what it could have felt like if I had just let it go and chosen kindness. And I had like a moment of, oh, the freedom, the space that I would have felt. Whereas now, you know, I feel not, I didn't beat myself up for it, but I just felt, you know, I could see it was coming from contraction. And I've had this experience many times. I find that when I have some kind of an insight in the sense of like an actual felt experience of what letting go or freedom could be, it's basically always in out of everyday experiences. And it's always when there's been that battle between sort of my wiser self and my ego, and the ego wins. And it's almost like I have to make the same mistake again, or I have to kind of reach rock bottom. And then I have the insight. Then like my heart really opens and feels like, oh, this is how it could have been different. And then, you know, it's, I don't really integrate it because it's a pattern. A while later, something similar happens again. So it's just, yeah, I guess I'm just observing that almost like the insight comes through the experience of the pain of repeating the pattern. And I'm wondering, like, I understand that experiencing pain, you know, is part of what helps us reach insights, but how do I help myself shift? I remember the insight when a situation like that occurs again, and help myself make a different choice, or just like, I kind of related to what Ayman was saying of like feeling that tug that like, I know I could behave differently, but the pull is so strong. And somehow, you know, the ego ends up saying, well, but under these particular circumstances, this time it's justified. So any thoughts at all about, yeah, just remembering those insights or having reminders?
Yeah, thank you, Carla. That's a nicely articulated. And just to call attention to the way she was talking about it, she didn't have to give any of the details of what she said or did or who the players were, but she really gave a clear sense of the whole pattern. So just as an aside, that's a nice way sometimes we, you know, how do we bring up very personal things? We can do it very deeply without having to divulge what we don't want to divulge. But that's an aside. So yeah, Dev, a lot of it, what you just said, Carla, is that noticing it. You really saw the suffering. You're really noticing like the first noble truth that there is dukkha here. You're seeing it more and more clearly of how that comes up. So you've done that. You sound like you've done that pathway many times, and you tend to go toward the ego side versus the wisdom side. But reflecting and noticing the impact of that, that helps bring more and more motivation to the next time it comes up. So at some point, you'll find that you'll make the different choice. You know, one way to kind of make it a little bit more, the learning a little deeper around it. I was doing this with my family, with my daughter and my wife, and around going on vacations. I had this pattern of like, okay, let's hurry up, let's get everything done. And I get really tight and kind of, you know, not very nice to be around because I want everything, you know, want us to hurry up and so we can relax on our vacation, right? And so I would notice the pattern, like you were saying, but still the pattern had all that momentum behind it. And so what I did is I actually asked them, tell me about how it's like to be around me in those situations. And I could hear, you know, the impact of it. And that really sobered me up because I can kind of feel that, you know, can feel the impact. But when you actually have someone that you care about telling you, just, it's not pleasant. We just get really on eggshells. We start to look at each other like, oh, he's gone down that road. All that really helps to bring a different level of energy when you really hear the impact. So depending on the circumstances of that interaction, and if it's appropriate, I have no idea if it is or not, but you might just go back and say that, you know, when I advocated for myself, I realized I wasn't as kind as I could have been. And I was wondering what that was like for you. You know, in some situations, some relationships, even a professional relationship, you can have that kind of a conversation. And sometimes, you know, it's people really are surprised that you're bringing that up. And if you're able to really set aside your, you know, defensiveness and just really listen and feel the impact of your actions, next time that comes up, you'll find that you have a much more likely to go down the wisdom side, the compassion side, than the ego side, because you feel the dukkha more and more. You see it more clearly.
Yeah, that is something I can do in a particular situation. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, it takes some courage. It takes, you know, some willingness to be vulnerable. But that's what this is about. You know, that whenever we find ourselves having to defend ourselves, that's often a place of ego, a place of constriction. I mean, sometimes it's discernment, but often it's that's conditioning. And, you know, and certainly that touch point, that choice point, that's, you know, what you're describing is really this really important, almost like a nice edge of, you know, I'm going to go down the delusion, the ego side, or I'm going to go toward the wisdom side. And for a while, it just feels like I have no idea which way I'm going to go. And eventually, though, that knife edge becomes a very broad path. And you're really clear that this is where I want to walk. This is the way I want to live my life. That's the integration of practice and life. Yeah, so thank you, Carla. All right, Emery.
Hi, Tim. Thank you. So I'm wondering if you have any guidance around developing this background availability that you talked about, sort of the integration into daily life of our moment-to-moment awareness. I think I tend to kind of take breaks from daily life. You know, like in my office when I'm working, I will stop and look out my window and there's a tree and really become immersed in that for 30 seconds. And it's very, well, sometimes longer, but it's very nourishing. And it does give me a different perspective when I go back to whatever it is I'm doing. Or like the dukkha that people have talked about tonight, Carla and others, I will take a break, like I'll take a stop from daily life to feel that and go into that. And sometimes that's, you know, needed, as you have said tonight, but I don't feel like I'm very skilled at maintaining this sort of background awareness moment to moment of what's happening. I don't reserve that 10% or that 20% of my attention to my body or the present moment. And it tends to be off or on for me. And I'm wondering if you have just some tips on how to cultivate that.
Sure. You know, so first of all, that willingness to take that little break, that little respite to regather your attention, that's very skillful. And that's a good thing to keep doing. Now, when you talk about being either on or off, when you're off, what is that like? Where's your awareness? What's your attention do in those moments?
I feel very immersed in whatever it is I'm doing. I just feel like, and sometimes it's a very speedy, busy engagement in the outside world, in, you know, listening to other people or getting things done, and sometimes it involves my brain a lot, trying to remember a bunch of things that I'm supposed to do and do them. And sometimes I feel immersed in whatever it is I am doing, especially if it's like with another person talking or listening, but it's not aware. It's just like, I feel immersed, but not as, I feel immersed in maybe my listening or my noticing of other things, but not much attention to my own experience, I guess.
All right. So I would say that you're aware, but just the awareness is maybe the other person or the situation and not so much on yourself. So is that the kind of the crux of the question? How do you keep awareness in yourself while you're noticing?
Yes.
While you're conversing. Okay. Well, one way to play with it is let's see. So when you listen to someone else, imagine that you're listening from the whole body is listening. So like, you know, sometimes therapists, when they're listening to someone, they're also noticing their own experience. So sometimes when, you know, a client or a patient is having some feeling, you might feel that in your own body. There's like that mirror neuron activity. So that's part of that information. You might notice, like, instead of like, when you, where does your eyes go? Like if you're just noticing their face, see if you can broaden a little bit and notice how is their breathing? You know, what are their hands doing? What are their feet doing? So you're just kind of broadening that awareness a little bit. And just including, you might just go through a few touch points, even just say to yourself, feet, breath, you know, just kind of a background, like a little, you know, little interjection, just like that technique of looking at the tree. You're just saying, you know, as I'm talking now, I can just, I'm not doing it mentally, but I'm just, you know, okay, there's my feet, there's my hand. I'm making a gesture with my hands. I can feel the movement against the air. So it's just a little, it's like you can still really stay engaged, but you just have a, it might be a lot simpler than you think it is. Just look for a little bit of that. Just a little bit of that. Just, okay, I can feel my butt touching the chair. You know, I can feel my, the way I'm gesturing. I can feel the awkwardness or the genuineness or whatever it might be in that moment. And don't have to make, perhaps what's happening is you're, maybe we can get into this, the kind of maybe the near enemy or of observation is analysis, that we see something and we have to make some story of it. Just kind of trust that you can just take it all in and don't have to make anything of it. And then somehow the mind and heart kind of takes all the information and puts it together in some response. And also has that ability to hear and feedback. So often when I do it, it's really not coming from a conscious place. It's just that, I mean, I'm present, but I'm not like, oh, I'm having that sensation, so therefore I'm having this experience. It's more like, oh, there's a little tension here. There's a little here. Feeling the feet, feeling the expression, seeing how she's nodding her head, noticing the background of your Zoom screen, you know, seeing people move around the hall. It's just kind of a broader, a little bit broader. Just try to make it a little bit broader.
That's very helpful.
Yeah.
It's like I kind of relate it to sometimes being in meditation and focusing specifically on breath or sound or body. And then sometimes when somehow you're able to take all of it in at once,
yeah,
and it's not so focused, it's just like the whole experience. So it's a little bit like doing that in daily life.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. That kind of more choiceless or spacious awareness is easier to hold, like Utajaniya, you know, teaches from that standpoint all the way through, just having that natural awareness. Mm. And I think it's helpful to have that ability to, you know, it's like you're just kind of available. Mm. And then, okay, there's something I want to really focus in on. Like, okay, it's like, oh, I feel like I'm about to maybe say something that's not completely true. I want to really tune into that and really bring like the broad awareness becomes very focused. Mm. So I can have that depth of seeing. And then, you know, okay, then there's the seeing and coming back. So it's this dance, it's this constant kind of movement back and forth.
Yeah,
play with that in other times, things which are less doing the dishes, see if you can do the dishes, but also be aware of the space in the room. Be aware of the sounds and the light play, and you know, it's like you're just letting different things be present, be known.
Very helpful. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, Emery. All right, so we've come to our stopping time. So I want to thank all of you for your engagement, your questions, and your listening. Next week we'll have a discussion around this. And we need some volunteers to help with Monday night greeters. So if you come regularly, please consider talking to May. If you could raise your hand, May, and she will set you up. All right. So I'll see you next week if you can make it, and enjoy your week of practice.